I'm Jody, the mom.
And I'm Dr. Barr, the doc.
And this is Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas.
We bring together the mom experience and the doc expertise to give you the information and tools you need to help make the next right decision to get your child back.
Let's dive in.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Mom and Doc Talk. We are honored and pleased to be nearly wrapping up the season today with yet another guest who is here to share her story about how PANS showed up in her life. And so we're always very, very happy to have every guest that we can possibly have, because every story that we get to share is a story that's going to impact somebody. And every little bit, so there's a little bit of difference in every story. And those little bits of difference are what somebody needs to hear to connect with, this might be what's happening in my family. This might be the thing that can help us deal with the thing that's happening in my family. So, yeah. Marianne, I'm so grateful that you're willing to come and share and join us today. I'm going to read a quick bio and then we're just going to dive in. Marianne is a special needs mom, a reader, a writer, an editor, a relentless researcher, and cannot handle scary movies. So basically, we're twins, except for the special needs mom component. Yeah. Her superpower is that she can recite obscure facts and myths and legends, but can't keep track of her car keys. What's your favorite obscure fact?
Well, I've been really into giants lately. I don't know why. I will talk to, you know, anyone who's willing to talk about giants with me. I'm like, did you know that they were finding giant bones in like the early 1900s? And, you know, the Smithsonian was sponsoring digs to go find them. And now if you ask them today, they're like, whoa, we don't have anything. That never happened. It happened. But anyway, I get really into that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like newspaper clippings of come dig up giant bones. And then later they're like, that never happened. We don't have nothing. No.
Yeah.
That's really into that kind of stuff.
You have far more interesting obscure facts. I don't have the best obscure facts. I would never win at trivia or Jeopardy or anything like that. But
I'm not sure I could either. No one needs to know about giants. Like, it doesn't matter.
Well, you never know. If they have like a myths and legends specific trivia, you'd probably clean up. My only random fact that I always remember is that porcupines and armadillos have their mammary glands in their armpits. That's my favorite obscure fact.
No.
I mean, that information will get you somewhere in life.
Right?
Yeah. If you ask my Weston, like, he knows all kinds of random things about birds.
Yeah.
I don't believe him when he talks about it. I'm like, there's no way that's true. And then I look it up later. I'm like, how did he know that? Like, I don't even know that. That sounds made up. Oh, I guess it's not. I don't know how he got it, but yeah.
Jody, do you have any fun obscure facts that you can share?
I don't, but as you're talking, I'm like, oh, this is like so Avery. Avery's my obscure fact kiddo. She is like constant. I'm like, it must be so cool to be in her brain and like all the random stuff, not only that she thinks of, but that she also researches. And same with her. She's a bird kid. She's like an old soul. And she is a bird watcher and a bird facts and a bird, all of the type thing. So I just am always
membership to the aviary. We go very frequently.
I'm not an obscure fact person. But I enjoy interacting with those that are.
All right. Well, unfortunately, this is not the Obscure Facts podcast, so we're going to dive in a little bit more for what
people
are
actually. Although it would be super interesting, but yeah.
So you gave us a little bit of a bio, but tell us a little bit more about yourself. What makes you tick?
So like I said, I'm a writer and a reader, and I'm a traveler. Oh, I didn't have kids till I was in my early 30s. And so my husband and I did a ton of traveling. I wanted to be a travel writer. That was my goal in life. And so spent a lot of time in Europe. You know, I just thought, you know, then I start having kids and I'm like, well, I just wait for them to get older and then we all travel together. It'll be great. And then stuff happens and you end up not doing it. So instead, I turned to local stuff. And I'm so I get obsessed with local history. And my kids are like, yeah, we go out to the strangest places on a Saturday just to go see the ghost town or something. You know, just because I keep my brain active. I'm like, okay, so I can't travel to Hadrian's Wall in England, but I could go find the local mine and find out what their story was, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of just kind of a seeker. I'd say as a person, I'm a seeker. Always kind of looking for just ways to make my brain grow, you know, especially when you're in a special needs world, you kind of look for your outlet. You need your outlet, right? So, I mean, I'm a writer and I had to quit my job when Weston was like, I think he was five or six. But yeah, I had to quit. And I've just been like doing freelance ever since. But it keeps my brain awake and I like it. But I'm not that interesting of a person. Like I like to snowboard. When I'm physically fit,
I'm already like, okay, I would love to just hang out with her and learn, like, just talk about all these random things. So I would largely
like on the other side of my mountain over here is like five mines. Why does no one talk about this? Because no one cares. I do. When I'm stuck in my house, I care. Anyway, so that's kind of what makes my brain tick.
Welcome. We're very happy to have you here.
Yes, very much so. I feel like my girls and I used to listen to a podcast of a woman who would like just run around and do stuff like that. But then she would tell a story, but it was like set up for young kids and like teenagers to learn things from. I feel like you might need your own podcast.
People tell me that sometimes. I'm like, you realize I'm just reciting stuff someone else told me. So I know lots of interesting things to me, but they're really, really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Well, so
take us back to the very beginning and talk to us about how Pans first showed up in y'all's life.
Okay. Well, so Weston, I have two boys on the spectrum and they're level two-ish. You know, I mean, I don't know what we're calling it anymore. I sort of divorced myself from a lot of the stuff when Pans hit because I'm like, I can't handle autism world. I can't handle anything. We're just burning and we're just going to deal with the burning and that's all we're going to do. So they're mid-functioning, I would call them. And so, you know, he and his brother, I have four kids. I have my oldest daughter and my youngest little boy, but then the two middle ones are both fairly high special needs. And I never felt like with autism that, you know, people will describe autism as I had a normal kid one day and the next day I didn't, or they regressed really quickly. That did not happen to us. And neither of my boys that actually happened to. It felt like a really slow burn of whatever was happening. So when Pans hit, it was overnight. It was, and people dismissed it around him, dismissed it. Oh, this is autism. Like, yeah, they're unpredictable like this. And I remember sitting in the principal's office one day because, you know, anyway, that whole year was a saga. But she, you know, they all at school, everyone thought this was just normal autism behavior. And I'm looking around going, autism didn't steal him. Whatever stole him this year, you know? And so I was very confused by it. Suddenly he developed like his autism traits were kind of, he wasn't a big stimmer. Like he did visual stimming, like holding stuff out and looking at it. And he could climb fences by the time he was like 10 months old. He like had crazy balance and didn't sleep, didn't talk well. So he was pretty much, he was diagnosed as PDD-NOS at the time. They weren't as trigger happy with the autism label then. It was pervasive developmental disorder, non-specified. And that's all they gave me, you know? And the guy's like, he'll probably grow out of it. It's literally what they said to me.
Yeah.
I'm like, cool. That's nice to know. And so his behaviors weren't extreme. I mean, he had struggled potty training and stuff, but when the Pans hit, phobias, anger, like irrational targeting of the little brother. Like they're Weston is sensory defensive and his younger brother is sensory offensive. That's what I call him because he's loud. He's never quiet ever, ever. And so they were oil and water for that reason alone. And they didn't get along well, but suddenly he started irrationally targeting him out of nowhere. At school, they started to tell me that he would, you know, he would only walk on certain tiles. And if the light hit it wrong, he wouldn't move. And they were just talking like, this is normal. Like, I started hearing about this later because he was behaving strangely at home, too. And then this school report started coming in. And I'm like, they're like, oh, we just thought he did that. I'm like, no, he doesn't. Like, what is this? And then the violence started. And then he started irrationally targeting people, usually his little brother. He started to fear for his life. And he was eight, I think. And 8-year-olds might be afraid that their mom's going to die, but they don't care about themselves. They don't think they can die. But he suddenly was afraid of dying. Like everything was out to hurt him. And, you know, all the adults in his life around him were going to injure him somehow. Like this. And then phobias and hallucinations started happening at bedtime. He started yelling at something I couldn't see. Anyway, all this stuff started happening within like a month. And it happened so quickly that I didn't recognize, you know, no one had mentioned, I mean, I hadn't heard anything about Pans before. which is not actually true. My daughter had an illness like several years before that, where she was sick for like 6 weeks. And she had a weird period after where she had higher anxiety and didn't sleep. And it took her a long time to kind of recoup back to normal. And the doctor, I have a pretty good pediatrician, and she brought it up. She goes, well, I've heard of this thing called PANDAS. And maybe, and knowing what I know now, that's not what happened. Like she just has, you know, because she went back to normal fairly quickly, but she brought it up. So at least planted that in my head that that could be something. And then like, you know, 8, 10 months into this, we go camp at the beach in San Diego every year in Carlsbad. And he got a ear infection. And when we got home, he was so feral, and I will call him feral. When I took him to the doctor noticed from April to October, she's like, who is this? I had to carry him in on my back. He was screaming and crying. She offered to come out to the car, and she'd seen him since he was a baby. He'd never done that before. She literally called me after and she said, what happened to him? You know, like what happened? So he had an ear infection. So we gave him antibiotics for the ear infection. And for the first time in like a year, we had a week of no violence. We had a week of no behaviors. Like it was this relief that we're like, oh, well, something physical is happening here. So it only worked for so long. In fact, when the antibiotics ran out and it started to come back, the behavior started coming back. I remember calling the doctor. I'm like, I don't know what's happening, but can you put him back on the antibiotic? She's like, sure, whatever. Cause she had seen it. When the cool thing about my pediatrician is she's now like, she advocates for it. When she sees it, she's like, oh, I know what this is, you know? And but she was very supportive, but she didn't know what to do. So we kept him on antibiotics for a while. It only helped a little. And ibuprofen and antibiotics are what we did. And I'm already launching into like the treatments we did, but oh, we lived in a fire all the time, right? I mean, he didn't sleep and no one was safe and he was self-injuring and all these things that sometimes autistic kids do, but he hadn't up until like suddenly he started doing it all overnight.
So you lived in this for a year before you realized that this was, you knew this wasn't just autism, but
this is not autism.
Yeah. Really couldn't figure out. Were you seeking an understanding of what it was during this time? Or were you just, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is autism.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember sitting there and telling someone like, I don't know what happened to him, but this is like something stole him and I don't know what it is. And I was kind of asking the questions and I'm like, but when you have two autistic kids, you're just like, well, maybe this is what autism is going to turn into for him. You know, they change.
Yeah.
So I was second, because that's what everyone tells you. Like the doctor's like, well, he's autistic. The school's like, well, he has autism. You know, of course he's going to behave weird. And I look around like, this is not autism. I don't know what this is. And like the OCD got so severe. Like we joke about OCD. People like to joke about OCD, but I can't joke about it because it's so terrifying. Like the real OCD is very terrifying. And compulsions. Like, I'm like, this is not autism. Like autistic kids don't like drink so much water that they vomit. You know, I mean, they might be obsessed with water and playing with it, but drinking it till they vomit, you know, I mean, and there were just differences, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it took until we ended up on antibiotics that it clicked. Like, this is not autism. Like I was questioning it, but everyone tells you, oh, it's autism, you know? So I sometimes wonder if a lot of autistic kids actually have this and they don't know because it just gets covered up in the autism diagnosis, you know? So we ended up, and I also knew that when he took ibuprofen, he calmed down, but I couldn't keep him on ibuprofen full time. Like that's just terrible. So I couldn't do that. The antibiotics was the first trigger that told us that this was a physical problem.
Yeah. And I know oftentimes whenever our kids go on antibiotics, we have that like, oh, like thank goodness.
It's a relief at first.
And then we go off of it. And then it just seems like PANS just kind of snowballs and just gets worse and worse as time goes on. Did you guys have any other symptoms? I know you've already talked about some symptoms, but, you know, whenever symptoms came back after you got off antibiotics, was it more stuff that added on? Did things just get worse?
It seemed like there was something new. That always seemed like we were adding. What was interesting is we ended up over time being able to chart it. Like I had, you know, he was, you know, we had a therapy team around all the time. And so I had this one therapy team that were like, we started to chart the flares. And this is when we started to be able to pinpoint the flares to an illness, allergies or whatever happened. And so I would start. So he would have like a period where he was okay. And then we started to track the cycle because he'd be okay. And then suddenly, like, he wasn't doing this. His compulsions were gone. You know, the OCD was really quiet and, you know, he could handle being around everybody and it was okay. And then suddenly something would happen and he'd have a spike of having a hallucination at night or something like that out of nowhere. And then we knew that's phase one. Phase two is he's going to get sick. And then he would get sick, whether it was a cold or the flu or if it was allergy season. And then phase three, we called it the demon, because phase three is when the demon took control and he wasn't himself anymore. And that phase could last anywhere from, you know, 2 weeks to 6 months. I mean, we could never tell, but you could tell when he came out of it, because he'd wake up one morning like it was gone. And he'd be really shaky, like he's in recovery trying to process what just happened. And then he moved to phase five, which is where he's fine. You know, like, it was really weird. And we could, like, the therapy team would come over and be like, we're full-blown phase three. And they would know what that meant. And that meant, be careful, because he's going to come after you, you know. So, like, it was cyclical. We could watch it. We knew what phase he was in. And so, like, these phases, I mean, the darkness, and he wouldn't remember them. Like, he'd come into phase four and he'd be like, why is Lucas, my little brother, afraid of me? I'm like, well, you almost murdered him. That's why. You know, I'm like, we were considering, well, he needs to move out because you can't be near him. But he didn't remember that. He's like, why is he scared of me? Like, you know, it was hard to watch, because it's like his memory would blank what had happened in those periods. So
what details? Yeah. What I'm curious if there's details you might be willing to share, just because, some of what you're sharing is not as common in PANS, but it does happen. And so, for instance, the hallucinations, it's not everybody who has PANS. It's not part of the diagnostic criteria, and it can absolutely happen. So I'm curious if you can share what that looked like in your home and how you knew that's what was happening. If you can give any more details about what the OCD and the compulsions might have looked like, because again, a lot of times we've got this idea of what OCD is. It doesn't necessarily match up with reality. So the more often people share what OCD actually looks like in your home, the more people can see when that's happening to them.
Okay. So one thing I will say is he was on trazodone to sleep. Like, they put him on it when he was three, because he didn't sleep. And it was magic. It made him sleep. But I should have cycled him on and off of it. Instead, I left him on it. So I'm just like, well, we're sleeping now, so who cares? I think that affected the hallucinations. I honestly think that helped trigger them.
Yeah,
that is my personal opinion, because when I took him off of it, that part of PANS disappeared.
Yeah,
he didn't have the hallucinations. Well, I mean, he did sometimes, but not nearly as often. So I think the medication was triggering some of that.
That is an important detail. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah. Yes, and also, like, he had some other things that I didn't attribute to PANS. Like, he had like trembling fingers and pins and needles in his feet, and that was the trazodone. Like, I know that for sure. So he's going through all of this all at the same time. I'm trying to get him off the trazodone, and I know that kind of melted his brain down for a long time. But the compulsions were things like, and this is a really gross one, but he couldn't have a bowel movement. And when he did, he thought he had lost part of himself, and he'd make this big, he had this routine, this ritual of pretending to get it and put it back in. And he did it every time. Like, it's like he lost part of himself, and that was dangerous. Like, an organ came out or something, you know what I mean? So that was a compulsion he had. That was kind of an obsessive thing he did. He would start drinking water, and he would drink a lot of water, and it had to be out of one specific tap. Cause I'm like, oh, my water in my fridge is filtered. Water's good for you, right? But he was drinking out of a specific tap, and it had to be out of that tap. And it was so much water that he started to hurt himself. Like, you can drink too much water, by the way.
You can.
He would drink so much that he would vomit. And so now he's learned that if he ever needs to throw up, just drink a ton of water and then he'll vomit. Like, that's like now in his more adult phase, he's like, oh, I don't feel good. I'm just going to drink a lot of water until I throw up. And he knows that. But the other compulsions he had were like coming downstairs had to be in a very specific pattern, and he had to be able to touch the wall. Like, he had to be able to run his hands down the wall in a certain way. And then that morphed into, like, it was really, like, it's really heart-wrenching to even think about, because he would stand on a chair and he needed to, like, touch the wall coming down. But that wall was out of reach for him because he was little. And so, like, dad would have to go upstairs and hold him coming down the stairs so he could touch the wall until he could let it go so he could go down the stairs. I mean, it's really heartbreaking to even think about, but that's the kind of like intense obsessions he had. Like, I have to touch this wall or, I mean, you hear about OCD where like, if I don't wash my hands 20 times then someone's going to die. And that's real OCD, right? So like his compulsions were that intense. He became afraid of stuff he didn't care about. When he was in the phase three, like he became afraid of things that normally he didn't care about. Dogs, he was convinced, could eat you, even if it was a little one, you know. So we don't have a dog in my house to this day, even though we'd like one. But he was convinced that dogs could eat you. And so anytime he saw a dog hiking at the park, that just ruined it. And he would get panic attack level, I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. So it just, because it was so extreme, it wasn't just like, oh, I'm nervous around dogs. It was, I'm going to die and I will run into traffic to get away from that dog. So stuff like that. I mean, it's pretty intense.
Yeah.
So it wasn't minor. I would say like, you know, it wasn't minor.
Yeah. There was both concerns about safety for him and safety of others, it sounds like, that would come up when he was in a flare. And
yes,
the flares could last, as you said, for weeks to months. You didn't know how long they were going to go. There was some relief from the ibuprofen that when you would give it, and you had some relief from antibiotics. So that leads us into the next question that we generally ask parents is, you know, these are the things that showed up. What treatments did you try? Was it just the antibiotics and the ibuprofen, or were there other things?
Well, I ended up being referred to a doctor in my local area who kind of is the only one who knows anything about pandas. So everyone gets sent to him, but he treats it very physically and clinically, right? So he's like, we're going to give you Zoloft. Is it Zoloft? Yeah, Zoloft. That's the anti-anxiety. We're going to give you Zoloft and we're going to give you heavy antibiotics. And then he would run testing and see like, okay, what of your like histamine markers are too high, or what can we target the antibiotic to whatever your body thinks it's fighting? And so he did a little bit better of a job. We did B12 shots. He's like, he was just throwing stuff at it. Like, we're just going to try stuff. But at least he believed me, you know, at least he believed this was a thing. Uh-huh. He was trying all kinds of things. I know he could have ordered the IgG, the immunoglobulin stuff. He wasn't a big believer in it, so we never tried it. He was just like, he was all like, we're just going to go antibiotics. That's what we're going to do. And he kept him on it for probably 2 or 3 years. Even when it stopped working, like he took it, but nothing made a difference anymore. So then I kind of kept going to him, but then I picked up another doctor, an integrative pediatrician. He was out in Long Island and he's one of these warrior guys that just like, our kids are sick. And he approached it in a different way. And he had me doing lots of supplements and some anti-parasite meds, which actually helped quite a bit in some ways. But I did my best to get him off of all meds. Like, I didn't want him on Zoloft. We tried Prozac a little bit, and like everything made him worse. He gained a lot of weight really fast. He just developed facial tics and body tics and stuff like that. So I tried really hard to get him off of meds, and I ended up letting go of the pandas doctor when he pretty much told me, all that's left is risperidol. We're going to have to go antipsychotic with his meds. And I'm like, and we're not coming back. And that was the last time I saw that doctor. And not that he wasn't useful. Like, you know, I feel bad about it, but I was at a time where I'm like, I have successfully gotten him off meds. I know he's a mess, but I'm not putting him back on him because it just makes it worse, you know. And for all I know, the meds made him susceptible to PANS in the first place. So
yeah,
I don't know. So we did the traditional medical stuff, and I tried really hard to get him off. And then we went the supplement and anti-parasite route, and things would be like good for a little bit. And then when they got bad again, they were worse than they were before. You know,
yeah.
We'd have a new one. We'd have a new flare. It'd be like, oh, well, now the OCD has shown up. Like, that wasn't there before. It was just phobias. And now it's like, you know, now the compulsions are really strong, and self-injury. Self-injury was a bad one. And he would only do that in a flare.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting that, had you shared that the trazodone had been part of what you believe was a trigger for the hallucinations and like some of the neurological symptoms?
I did to the pediatrician finally, because we were trying to figure out why he seemed to have ear ringing he stopped wanting to walk very far. And this wasn't PANS. This was the medication, I think, and the hallucinations. Because I remember telling the doctor, I'm like, he's got these things. And we went to a neurologist. We went to an ENT because he was like fighting his face so much. We're like, something under there is bugging him and he couldn't communicate well. And we went to like 12. I counted at one point. There were 12 doctors, 12 specialists. We were trying to figure out what's happening. Not one of them asked, what meds is he taking?
Yeah.
Not one of them.
Well, I'm curious if you shared it with the PANDAS doctor who ended up putting him on.
Yes.
You did.
Yes.
Okay. And they still gave you other medications that had similar action in the body.
Yeah. It's like no one believed that was a trigger. I thought no one believed that. I thought that was really odd as later on, I'm like, how did no one ask, should he get off these meds? And is that, but the meds cause very specific symptoms. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have caused the cycling sickness, darkness,
for sure.
Recovery. But like, but the hallucinations for sure. I'm pretty sure that was the trazodone that was causing that.
Well, and there's definitely a greater likelihood of having negative reactions or sensitivity to SSRIs, but psych meds in general. And kids with PANDAS tend to need a substantially lower dose to have positive effects because they're so much more sensitive and can have negative reactions that look like, for some people, myself included, it looks like you're triggering a manic episode. Or psychosis, when really it's just, nope, the medication, yes, it's part of your susceptibility. It ends up becoming important later on when you pursue homeopathy, but it sends you down the wrong path so frequently using these medications. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was surprised no one ever brought it up. They're like, what's he taking that we should get him off of to see if we can return at least partially to baseline? Because I used to say like, okay, there were levels, right? They're like, it was just PANS we were dealing with, we might be able to do that. But the hallucinations on top of it, that was, you know, and the not being willing to walk and all kinds of stuff like that was the meds. But then we brought him down to that and we got him off of those. And then we're like, oh no, like this is still fire, fire, fire.
Yeah.
And I used to tell like Dr. Mosley's our homeopath. And I would tell him like, if I only had to deal with autism, I think I could survive.
Yeah. It's a lot to have.
But this layered stuff is so hard.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, so I'm curious. It sounds like you went a year with this happening and no support. Just like, is this autism? And everybody telling you it was autism. And then finally having antibiotics and seeing, oh my gosh, things get better. And the anti-inflammatories, okay, things get better again. And it sounds like somewhere in there you got the PANDAS diagnosis, or at least the suggestion, saw the PANDAS doctor. Well,
and we went to a psychologist for that.
Okay.
Psychologist diagnosed him with it.
Okay.
That's
amazing.
Much told him.
Yeah.
I told him like, I think this is what it is. He's like, I think you're right.
Yeah. And then from there, lots and lots of other things. When did you finally get to the point that you came to homeopathy, and what led you there in the first place?
So being a special needs mom, like having my two autistic boys, I obviously, you're online a lot, you know, when you're obsessively researching what on earth can I do. My second son, we had started him with this integrative pediatrician who had found that he had he had the B. burgdorferi markers. And so he very likely, he never, you know, didn't get bit by a tick that I know of, but he, you know, when your immune system's whacked out, sometimes it's doing stuff like that. And so he was testing for stuff and finding stuff. And so I was in like Lyme disease groups. I was in like, you know, just autism groups, like the biomedical groups for autism. Like, okay, do you do chelation? Do you do all these supplements? You do all these things. And so we were already pretty fully down that path. We were doing diet. We were doing, you know, gluten and casein free and dye free and not totally sugar free, but trying, you know, like we were as hardcore as we could get, you know, with stuff like that. And so I was in a million groups, you know, just like hunting. And I had joined your practices, Facebook group probably a year before. So when we were in the middle of like, I don't think antibiotics are helping. I know I'm making him worse. And I don't know what to do. So I was just looking for alternate, like just experiences, like people out there have this happen. What do they do? So I had joined, I think, the Facebook group and was just reading. I think I read for like a year. I just read stuff. And then we had like one big, the time that we fired the PANDAS doctor. And my other doctor was like, he put him on an anti-parasite med, which helped at the time. But, and because I'm like, we're not doing anti-psych meds. I can't do psych meds. I can't ruin his life this way. And And I'm like, we're going to lock ourselves into our house and not go out if that's what it takes. But I can't, you know, I'm not going to institutionalize them and I'm not going to medicate the crap out of them because neither of those are going to help. So I think after we had this, we had a really massive meltdown. Like it was one of the bigger flares I'd ever seen. That's when I pulled the trigger. I'm like, this can't continue. This can't continue. So we're going to find something else. So that's when I first finally called. I think that was in 2020. It was in 2020. So I finally called. We'd been dealing with it for about 2 years, 2.5 years by that point. Just riding the dragon, I guess.
Riding the dragon. That's,
I don't know if that's the right term because I think that's a drug use term. But anyway, but yeah, we were just riding the waves of it. And we had already started noticing all the flares and the signals. And we knew what phase he was in. But I'm like, how do I end this? Can I end this? Is it possible to end this? I don't know. So that's when I finally called and got my consult set up. I think it was in the fall of 2020 that we finally did it. So
tell us a little bit about Weston's healing journey and kind of start us at the beginning, give us a little bit of the middle and kind of the end, how that's gone.
Okay. Well, one of my favorite memories is my intake appointment. I just love Dr. Mosley so much, by the way. Like, she's just phenomenal. But that intake appointment was the first time, like, I don't know how long we're on the phone, like an hour or 2 hours. Like, she just gave me whatever time. And it was like the first personal therapy session I'd had to process what had been happening. Because, you know, you go to the doctors and they're like trying to, you know, they brush you off or like, well, he's autistic. And what do you expect from me? And this was the first time someone actually sat and listened. Besides my Long Island doctor, he was pretty cool, but he wasn't as versed in this stuff. To have someone like ask the right questions, like she knew what was happening. And I'm like, no one has talked to me like this before. Like I got off the phone, I started crying. I'm like, someone understands this, you know, because you feel pretty isolated. You feel alone about it. You're like, I can have doctors I can talk to. And they, you know, and I'm trying to convince the school that this is a real thing. And everyone around him and his therapy team, they're just, you know, they don't know what to do either. And like to finally talk to someone who understood what was happening and asked the right questions, the probing questions that I'm like, oh my gosh, you get this. You get this. Like, I'm not having to defend what I'm saying. You believe this is happening. And here's, you know, and so that first, I remember that intake so well because I was just like, oh my gosh, someone gets us. So when we start, I mean, it wasn't a smooth start. I don't think anyone has a smooth start to anything because we were coming off of all meds. I took them off, antibiotics, cold turkey. I'm like, we're done with this. Like, it's not doing anything. I got him off all his psych, like his Zoloft. I was still weaning him off of that. So in the beginning, he was extremely sensitive. So he was one of those water dosing kids, you know, like, so you would have to, you know, you call it second cup water dosing. It had to be that diluted or, you know. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, I'm not sure we saw a ton right away, but enough that I thought this is worth it. You know, okay, so we're off all meds, but, you know, and one of the things to me that was, I mean, the most hope is that, like, she could predict how he was going to react based on what she had learned about him. And she was 8 times out of 10 right. And I'm like, how are you getting this? How do you know this? How do you know this? Mm-hmm. She's like, well, he's probably going to do this and this and this. And then was right. So after about a year, I'm like, I don't care if progress is really slow. We actually know what we're doing here, you know? Mm-hmm. And so he only went through 2 or 3 remedies. He really didn't have that many for as long as we did it. We did like 5, like I talked to Dr. Mosley just like a couple weeks ago, a month ago. And she's like, I think we're done. And he's only on maybe his 4th remedy. So his were a good match from the beginning. And I know that people have to go through a lot of them before they kind of find the right one. So his were a good match from the beginning, but we could start to see the shortening, like in the first year, we started to see the shortening of the phase 3, like of the really hard part that started to get, and it started to be less scary. And it started to be, you know, like they were similar things. It was still compulsions and things like that, but then they were less severe. And then he would come out of it quicker, or he would recognize what he was doing quicker, or he started sleeping better, or he started falling asleep better. Like things just started dropping off. Mm-hmm. You know, and each flare was still kind of bad, but that one that we'd been experiencing for a year was gone. You know, that one didn't come back. And we picked up a couple new ones later. So we were always tracking something, but we just noticed that things were like just slowly. In the beginning, I didn't see a ton, but in the middle, we saw like really cool improvement. Like, oh my gosh, like we haven't cycled in like 3 months. And that was so that became longer between phases. And then like he started to develop some, like the real severe ones kind of hung on and we could kind of see those hanging on. But the minor ones started to disappear. I'd say the middle, I started to feel really hopeful in the middle. Like, I think we're going to get there and it just might take a while. Mm-hmm. And people start with the home started to calm down a little bit. We didn't, but in a flare, like we knew, you know, everyone knew to keep their distance and get out of the way. So like 2022, 23, like, you know, it started to get a lot better, but he still had some severe ones. One of his phobias was about people, like adults in a school setting. And I think that's from some trauma that I don't know that he had, but adults in a school setting were dangerous. And so he ended up being put in a special needs school 3 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, because no school could handle him. Cognitively, he probably needs it, but behaviorally, like no one could handle him. He was getting bigger. And when he'd go after adults, it was severe. And so he had to be put in this special needs school. And they just knew, A, only certain people could handle him, and B, don't compliment him because it made him ragey, and C, like just all the, like they had to learn him, but it was really rocky. And so towards the end, like he just picked people that he thought were evil, and he would talk about them like they were evil. And these are people like, what did they ever do to you? So, I mean, we had periods of not being able to see family because he decided some family were evil people. And so we couldn't be in the same location as this family. And that went on for a little while. I think one of the biggest things I want other people to know, like the last hurrah. I'm a big believer in the last hurrah. I don't know if that's what we're calling it, but it's just like, I remember telling Dr. Moslem, like, it feels like this could be the big last, because this the big finish. Like stuff had dropped off, but these major ones were still pretty bad. Like he wasn't self-injuring as much. His compulsions were way down. His OCD had disappeared within a couple years. So in a flare, it was just like they weren't as bad, but there were certain things like being angry at certain people, angry at himself, negative self-talk, hating his brother. Like these are things that just had a hard time. Mm-hmm. But then because he'd gotten so much better, but this last flare, I don't know if you call it the last hurrah, but it was so, so bad. Mm-hmm. And it lasted probably 6 months. I mean, it wasn't a fast one. It was not quick. And, you know, we broke TVs and we had windows and holes in the wall, stuff we had, like we thought this was behind us, and it all came back. Like it all came back. And I remember being like, we're back to square one. Like, we're back to, like, he hates everyone. No one's safe around him. He wasn't sleeping, and he wasn't really hallucinating at that point, but he would get up in the middle of the night, and we had to lock kids in rooms, and mm-hmm. I had to have, you know, again, I don't tell these stories to people who don't understand this kind of behavior, because it makes him sound like such a monster, you know, but which, when he was good, man, he's such a sweet kid. Mm-hmm. And so I just, you know, you finally had to learn, like, this is not him, he's not being himself, and... But it was bad. Like we were like way back to the beginning, like phobias, dogs can eat you. People are evil. So everyone's trying to murder me. Like, you know, self-injury, almost broke his own nose. I mean, like crazy, crazy stuff. He had several incidents in school that was so violent. They had to put a isolation booth in his room for him, which was triggering to him because he called it the oven. And they had to use it on him a few times. And I don't really grudge them for that because I've seen him. I've been injured by him. So I know how dangerous he is when he's like this. And he's not himself. So you do what you got to do to keep him safe and the people around him safe. So it was really, really bad.
And you pulled through. It was right? Like,
yes. Yeah. Okay. Oh, that. And this was, so we're talking, this is 2024, by the way.
Yeah. Right.
2024. So we'd been at homeopathy for about 4 years, maybe 3.5 years or whatever. And we'd watched this crazy progress, and then it was like landing at the bottom. And this lasted for probably 6 to 8 months, I think. Like it was pretty long. Like we had some reprieves in there, but it never really went away until literally, I think it was October or November of 2024, when he like woke up one day and we never saw it again. And I mean, to this day, I have not seen it again. This year at school, like I went to his IEP a few months, like I might cry talking about this, but I went to his IEP a few months ago and it's kind of a newer team, but they were talking about how much they adore him and how they're like, we're not supposed to have favorites, but if you poke your head in the room, you'll be able to tell, you know, and he's buddy buddies with all the adults. This is the one that blows me away is he's been for 5, 7, 8 years, like terrified of all adults and he will talk about them like they're going to harm him. They're like, he's buddy buddies with all the adults. He has nicknames for them. They have inside jokes. He has his favorites and some he just tolerates, you know, but he doesn't talk about people like they're bad anymore. We were able to go to a family thing over Thanksgiving with the specific family members that he thought were evil and couldn't be around. And he's just like, whatever. We all looked around like, nobody move. Nobody move. I think we're okay. He's buddy buddies with adults. He is best friends with his little brother. Like, this is the one that will make you cry if you see it. Like, he was so horrible to him that my poor second son is very traumatized. Like, if he ever hears Weston escalating, he immediately goes in his room. He's like, what's going to happen to me, you know? And they're the best buddies. And I always tell him, like, you know, they're both autistic and they're probably going to be living with me for a long time, so you better get used to each other and enjoy each other. And they finally do. Like, these are the little miracles. No, these aren't little. These are big. But they hang out together. They're always hanging out together. They'll sit on the couch and, like, snuggle sometimes. I'm like, okay, you two big teenagers, that looks a little bit weird. But like, it's all, and I'm not kidding when I say it's, like, almost all gone. Like, he can get sick and I don't get nervous because there's no cycles. Mm-hmm. He hasn't had a panda cycle in like 2 years almost now, at least once the big one ended. And so I kind of wish I'd known about the last hurrah, like how bad that could be. But, you know, I call it the demon dying, but I'm sure people are a little more PC about it. But to me, it felt like the demon was like screaming and dying after that. Yeah. After that, I mean, it's hard to describe what life is like now versus 5 years ago. And I try to process what happened. And what led us to the help that we got, we abandoned everything and just did homeopathy for the last 3 years. Like, I haven't seen a single doctor besides a pediatrician every now and then for anything for the last 3 years. We just went straight homeopathy. So,
well, I want to make sure that I mentioned something that I think is worth saying for people who are like, oh my gosh, you were dealing with this for so long and, you know, doing, you know, the plodding along with homeopathy. One of the things that we do see is that people who have autism and PANS tend to have a more slow, it's like a slow and steady rather than big swings for the healing process. And it tends to be a slower process. So it tends to be a little bit more subtle, a little bit more gradual. Like you said, still having, even without the presence of autism, you're still going to have episodes and flares. We're just looking at changes in frequency, intensity, and duration, which is what you were describing all along until you got that to that big last hurrah. And the last hurrah is absolutely something that can happen. It's why it has a name. We talk about it. We've got an episode about it. We will link the episode in the show notes for anybody who wants to learn a little bit more about what the last hurrah is. And so one of the things, though, is that it's typically not 6 to 8 months that the last hurrah lasts.
I know.
I
assumed it would be weeks. So I'm like, this feels really severe. We're going to be done in like weeks or like a couple of months. And it lingered a long time.
Yeah, it's usually much shorter. It's usually a couple of weeks to a couple of months that it lasts. And for some people, it can last longer. And especially if you have the spectrum stuff that you're dealing with as well. I'm curious if you saw any changes with some of the things that you associated with being on the spectrum along the way, or if it was really just the PAN stuff that you saw changes in, since he had such a clear spectrum and then PAN's onset rather than like that more confusing state that some people have.
Well, one of the things Dr. Mosley and I tracked a lot was his speech, because he was very low speech. Like, you could tell he had his receptive communication's excellent. Like, he, you know, you talk to him and he's one of these autistic kids that knows you're talking about him if he's outside, you know, he knows what you're saying. Like, for they have that kind of ESP. They're like, you're talking about me and I'm mad about it. Like, his receptive is pretty good, but his speech was almost non-existent. Like, he'd say phrases and he couldn't advocate for himself at all. We watched his speech explode, you know. So it's almost like as his immune system was starting to re-regulate or whatever was happening, speech started coming out. And he's not conversational by any stretch right now, but he can talk now, you know. And so I don't know that I have lots of theories about it. I don't know that homeopathy brought that out or as much as it was putting out a fire potentially that helped him, that kind of unlocked the ability to, you know, so that his body was calming down so that it could actually focus on learning some skills that he just didn't have the capability of doing. So we watched speech improve significantly. Some of his other, like self-injury is very common in autism, very common. And we tracked that and that dropped off to almost nothing now. Mm-hmm. So he's not a self-injurer. So, I mean, these are things that are standard autism things that started to disappear. So he was, I mean, in the beginning, we were trying to get off of meds and I think that had scrambled his brain anyway. So we were fighting through layer after layer after layer. But we watched some of his classic. Well, and the sad thing is, like, his younger brother, like, is very classically autistic. He spins, echolalic and stuff. And he had to be put on the back burner while we just dealt with the fire. And not back burner, like, he still had therapy, still, you know, still gets, you know, the attention he needs. But you can tell which one I worked really hard at. Between the two of them, you can tell which one we worked really hard on. Mm-hmm. So, and we actually tried homeopathy with my younger son for a while too. And actually we saw some cool stuff there, but yeah, like some of his autism things started to just like unlocking speech, self-injury went way down. I think self-injury goes down because he can talk better. That's part of it. Mm-hmm. But also like there's not random pain in his head. There's not phantom pains. He's not angry. And so he's, you know, like his anger and all that has just dissipated to the point where, you know, I don't know.
Any change in any of the sensory stuff or like the stimming behaviors?
Yeah, he wasn't much of a stimmer, but yeah, like his rigid thinking, that was another thing. Like autistic kids are pretty rigid. And we actually, in the last year, the only time I will dose him with his remedy sometimes is when he gets stuck in a loop. And that's an autism thing, not a PANDAS thing, right? That's his brain gets stuck in a loop and he starts fixating on something. And I actually will dose him then and it helps. So, you know, the two get blurred in my head quite a bit because I use the homeopathy because he's not medicated at all. Like I don't give him anything except his homeopathy. And so his remedy that I use, like when he gets a hot temper or something like that, like he's a 15-year-old kid. So of course he's going to be angry sometimes. And, but I literally, that's when I use it. It's when his brain's stuck in a loop and he's in a really hot temper and he gets angry about something because, you know, he's aging, you know, but that actually helps calm him down, which I find
that's one
really
of the benefits that we can see where when you get you have the slower, more steady healing process with homeopathy when you have PANS and autism, but you get a bit of a twofer. Where you get broad improvement, you know, we're never going to change the way that he's wired because it's not right. Something that needs to be fixed necessarily, but we'll see the suffering associated with the challenges of the wiring start to improve as well. And that's, it requires some patience and persistence, and it can really have some pretty far reaching impacts for these kids, especially when there's more than one thing going on.
Yeah, we would work that out a little bit because I'd be confused, like, you know, somewhere in the middle, I'm like, well, this is an autism behavior. I don't, you know, are we tracking this? Or are we not tracking? Because we would track all the PANDAS behaviors. Uh-huh. But then we started tracking the autism behaviors too, because they were classically autism behaviors, you know, like self-injury and the lack, you know, we were tracking his speech and how his speech was improving and things like that. And we did definitely get a bit of a twofer that way because he's, you know, he tries, there are some things that are still pretty ingrained, like some of his fears of things. But we've seen, I don't know, like it's overwhelming when I get reports from school about how well he's doing. Like he's actually doing academic work for the first time since he was in first grade. They're like, yeah, well, he's blown through all his goals now. So we're moving on to this, you know, and he's never done that. Not since he was in the first grade. Not since this hit him has he been able to do any academic work whatsoever. It was just survival. So yeah. I mean, we've seen crazy improvements in a lot of different areas. We've seen, just like the rigid thinking and things like that. Like, it's crazy how homeopathy actually helps snap him out of those cycles. So I don't know. It's been a wild, wild ride. But I, you know, talking to a doctor a month ago, I'm just like, I think we've conquered it. Like, I now get my wish of just like, we'll just deal with autism now and it'll be great. It'll be great. I've been contacting all the people that saw him at his worst. And I mean, at his worst, like his therapy teams that, you know, we were churning through people because no one could handle him. And I'm like, you all need to know where he is now, because they probably all assumed he's going to be in an institution at some point, because at some times we thought we're the only one standing between him and institutionalization. So it was just that bad. So,
well, good for you for advocating for the children that are coming behind him and reaching out and attempting to just let those providers know that there are other outcomes than what is assumed. So as you guys are moving through homeopathy, Weston starts to improve, symptoms are resolving. Talk a little bit about how your family dynamic changed. And I know that you were talking about the boys and how they have a great relationship now, but your family dynamic as a whole, how did that start to shift as he moved through healing?
Well, you know, they always say that your family's only as strong as their weakest link, you know, and we knew for a long time, like, he just rules the house. He just does. Like, if he's in a bad mood, you're not doing anything. If he's in a phase, everything's on hold. Even a vacation might be on hold if he's not okay. And everyone knew that. And so it was like, if you could see it at the time when people knew if the behaviors were hitting, they'd scatter. Rooms would go close. That, you know, we weren't hanging out together. We were just like, okay, mom's going to take care of this or whatever. And I'm just going to go hide in my corner quietly and hope he doesn't decide to come after me. And so he could only live that way so long before we thought for a while, we're like, we need to maybe get an apartment that he lives in, because it's the whole house can't function this way. And so as he started to get better and the time between the phases, the flares would get longer. Everyone, you could tell everyone was just a little bit hopeful, like, okay, we can all hang out together right now. We can all hang out together because he's okay. He's okay. And that leaves a scar, I think, when everyone knows if this kid's off, we're all screwed, you know? So, as time went on and we started to be able to like do the family trips again, actually go camping or stuff that it was just a wild card. You didn't know if you could do it. I don't know. I think it's going to take us some time to heal from that. It's going to take some time. But dad and I were okay. We're both chill people, which is helpful, you know? And so I know a lot of people go through a lot of marital issues with stuff like this, and we seem to be okay. But like the family, like, we couldn't be around people. We got really isolated, and now we can go to family dinners. People are kind of surprised to see us sometimes because we show up and we bring everybody. And it's just like, it's like finding a new normal, like, which should have been normal, you know, but we're trying to find a new normal. We're like, he's really like, Weston is really into Disneyland, and now he's a pleasure to travel with. Like, we decided this year, we're like, we're going to take some trips this year because we haven't done it for 5 years, because we couldn't. We didn't know if we'd be on the road and everyone would have to exit the car, to pull over and exit the car, which has happened many times. And so he's just a pleasure to travel with. Like, kids all hang out together. It's just like, it's a different life, and we're trying to figure out how to be okay with it without being nervous. You know, like, they were always just a little bit nervous, like, it's going to vanish really quickly. And it's, you know, so.
It still feels surreal, right?
It's surreal. Like, I can't believe when he gets up in the morning, he's not raging and ready to punch the wall. He's just like, you know, he's fine going to school in the morning. I'm like, okay, let's go. He's like, okay, cool. And I drop him off at the curb and he runs in. This is a special needs school where everyone's like escorted into the building. And they're just like, oh, no, Weston, he owns this place. You know, he just goes in. They let him run up to his classroom. They let him go to his different things on his own. They don't need to escort him around. And he's happy. And they're like, he does his thing. He knows where he's going. He's responsible. He's like, it's wild. Like, they tell me these things and I don't believe they're talking about my kid, you know. So anyway.
Was there a specific spot in the healing journey where you were like, all right, we got this. Like, there's hope after feeling hopeless for so long.
I would say it was probably, it was within the first year of homeopathy, because we had obviously been at it for a few years before, and things helped temporarily, and no one knew what they were talking about, really. They're just like, well, we'll just throw drugs at it. And to me personally, psychologically, working with the homeopath regularly, who understood kind of what was happening, I was like, okay, remember, we got lots of options. We can change things up. Whereas doctors don't have options. They're like, well, we medicated or we don't. Like, what do you want to do? So we went, like, I think it was probably a year in when I started to see stuff calm down for the first time in years. And that's when I started to be like, I think we're going to get there. But then there were like the phases in between that were so terrible. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know how we hung in there, but I just felt like when it started to get better, it was better than what it had been before. So I'm like, as long as we're on the right track, I guess we don't have to fix it tomorrow. But if we're on the right journey, then I just abandoned everything. I'm like, okay, well, we're just going to do this. We're just going to do this.
Yeah. And what advice would you give to another parent who's just now starting their PANS journey?
Part of it is, first of all, like, it's hard to be patient. I know this for everyone, like, whether it's like losing weight or something like that, you want it to happen quickly. First of all, because you're miserable. And, you know, the idea that if something is too difficult to continue, it won't. So what does that mean? You know, but to be patient with it and just look at the long road. Like, you know, you can abandon it if you want, but then you won't know if it will work, and it would work, right? But it just takes some time to find the right thing. It takes some time to, and sometimes, I don't know, it will work out eventually, but people want things to happen quickly. That's why medications are so hard, because it's like, oh, well, we'll Band-Aid that like tomorrow, you know? But that's not how the body works, right? Like, you're calming stuff down systematically, and it's just going to take some time. And, you know, make sure there are people around the kid who know what's happening to him, because as soon as, you know, I had a very tight support team, and they didn't know how to help, but they knew what was happening. And so it was easier to be compassionate with him, knowing what was happening to him. And that this wasn't him naturally. This wasn't, you know. And we also knew, because we'd cycle, I'm like, eventually it will end and we'll go into a normal phase for a little while. We'll get a reprieve, and everyone knew it would end eventually. And so, I don't know, patience is just the biggest deal. And it's so hard to learn, because you want, like, you're miserable. You're miserable and you need it to end now. And it's just not going to, but.
Yeah. Patience. What about advice for parents who are considering their next steps as far as finding care for their child?
Care like doctors, like.
Like medical care, what are their next steps? I know we got a lot of people kind of evaluating between, you know, what are they going to, you know, mainstream medical, functional medicine, homeopathy, just any advice you have for anybody trying to, like, figure out that fork in the road place.
I found that anyone who just would look at symptoms and then want to medicate it was something to stay away from. People who wanted to test things, let's run some blood tests. Let's run some, you know, like, just behaviorally, or behavioral therapy can be helpful, but it's what's happening is physical. It's not just mental. So you have to address the physical part. And so anyone who just wants to medicate it and just SSRI it into oblivion is, you know, so like the functional medicine doctors that can do IgG or stuff like that, like, it's worth trying. But you have to look at the long term. We're looking at healing here, not just band-aiding what's happening. And I don't know that medicine, I don't even know if IgG will band-aid what's happening, but I don't know that it can. I've become a pretty big believer in just, like, the homeopathic medicine and natural medicines of, like, the body just needs the support it needs to fix itself, kind of, you know. And we make it so much worse sometimes with all the different medicines and things we do. But I think it needs to be a hybrid, at least in the beginning. You know, I mean, we went straight homeopathy after a couple of years, because I just given up on the dozen doctors we had, because they were useless to me after a while. And we just went straight homeopathy, and that was very, very successful for him, although it took a long time. Anyone who looked at your kid holistically, like support with diet, support with testing stuff to see if, you know, do you have Lyme? Do you have whatever, these things that everyone else kind of brushes aside? that you can tailor some treatment there to maybe put out some fires in the short term. Like, I think a hybrid's probably the best way to go, but anyone who just wants to medicate it away is not going to be successful.
What gives you the most hope about the future? The
fact that we have a life again, I guess. I mean, I don't know. That's a good question. But like, he's going to have a life now, you know, whether it's with me most of the time at home or whether he's going to be capable of doing stuff that I assumed he wouldn't. I assumed he wouldn't, and no one around him believed he would be. Because, you know, I'm like, as he grows up and he's an adult instead of a child, can we call it PANS? Or is he bipolar? Is he schizophrenic? Is he institutionalized? Is he all these things? Like, we were looking at a pretty dark future for him. And now we're like, yeah, he can do anything. I mean, not anything, obviously. Like, he's not going to be an astronaut. But like, his future opened way, way up in the last year. I thought, oh my gosh, he can be one of these kids that, like, he's obsessed with birds. He just knows things. I'm like, he could end up working in an aviary. He's really good at assembling things. He's like, you know, like, his talents have started just streaming out of him that we didn't know were there because it was hidden in what was happening to his body. And so I'm like, he's going to have a life now. And which means I will, you know, which means he's, you know, and so when we talk about like your family's only as functional as your weakest link, like when your weak link starts to be a shining star, you're like, okay, we're all going to be okay now. We're all going to be okay. And so, you know, my daughter, she's getting ready to go to college next year. And I, you know, she's looking at options. And I just thought, you know what? I figured you'd want to run screaming from your house, like as soon as you, the second you could. And this last year, she's like, I don't know, you know, maybe I'll go local. And I just thought, I assumed you'd be out of here. But she's just kind of like, her brother should become pleasant to be around. She actually has a bit of a relationship with him for the first time ever. Like, so from, you know, when he was little and they should have been friends, he was stuck in his world. And they actually have a little bit of a relationship now for the first time. And I'm not kidding when it's just like a brand new life. So I feel like we conquered it. And I will sing homeopathy's praise to anyone who listens. So,
well, Marianne, I'm so grateful for everything you were willing to come and share and the rawness you were willing to talk about things and the hope that you offer people, especially people who are on the long haul. You know, we've got, or as Jody calls them, the long healers, that healing is the thing that you need to focus on with just enough patience and persistence and just willingness to keep at it, even in the harder times, and focus on the wins that you have along the way to keep you going through those hard times, that you can really get to an amazing place, even when you're dealing with the long heel and multiple factors that are contributing that have been.
And your homeopath knows what they're talking about, too. So I remember thinking, like, what's this second cup stuff? Like, there's no way he's getting anything out of this. And so there were a time or two where I was tempted to like do my own thing with him. I'm like, in this one case, do exactly what she says to do. And ultimately that was successful. And so I'm like, okay, this is the one doctor that I follow her instructions to the T. I don't do that with any other doctor.
And I appreciate that you say that.
I do what she says to do. Mm-hmm. And that's a piece of advice I would give to him. Like, do what they say to do, because, you know, especially special needs parents like me, we're used to doctors telling us to do something and your instinct is like, I think you're wrong. And usually you are wrong. And so I'm used to doing my own thing. And they look at me like, you're not going to do this. Sorry. I'm like, heck no, I'm not doing that. I will do my own thing because I'm following my own instincts. But with the homeopath, I'm like, I just did what she said. I'm like, I will do whatever you say to do.
I will add, your homeopath actually has expertise and understands PANS pandas really well.
Yes. Yes.
And also
they
understands.
Have to know what this is.
The global picture of everything that you're dealing with from a medical perspective, a physiologic perspective, from all the treatments that you're doing, which is why at Resilience, we only hire naturopathic doctors who have training in the totality of everything so that we can really know, here's what's happening from this, here's what's happening from this, especially if you're in that hybrid approach, which not everybody needs, but many people take. And it's vital that you, if you're going to trust your homeopath, make sure you're actually working with somebody who earned that trust and deserves the trust.
It feels like if you get started early, and especially with a small child, like get started early, because then you're not spinning your wheels for 3 years, like two and a half years like we did. I think we might have shortened it up if we had actually pulled the trigger sooner. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, Marianne, I can't thank you enough for coming and sharing. And I'm so excited for all of the wins that you guys have had and all of the ways that your life is so much different than you ever thought it would be, especially once Pans showed up and took over the beast.
Yeah.
Was it the beast or the demon?
I call it the demon.
The demon. When the demon showed up.
And the demon left. So
I love that you get to take vacations and you get to come and hang out in my neck of the woods for camping trips every year. And once we eventually start our next side quest podcast that's all about random facts and things to be interested in, you'll have to
local mining towns. I'm your girl.
All right. Well, thanks so much again. And take care, everybody.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye, guys.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We would love to connect with you on social media and have you as part of our amazing community. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas.
If Facebook isn't your thing, you can also connect with us on Instagram and YouTube by searching for Resilience Naturopathic or clicking the links in our show notes. You can also visit our website, resiliencenaturopathic.com.
As always, we value your partnership in advocacy and education. Your support through following, sharing, rating, and reviewing our podcast is crucial in our mission to teach the world about Pans, Pandas, and homeopathy. So if you found this podcast helpful, please leave us a review. Together, we are making a difference.
And finally, this podcast really is for you. Your questions and feedback help us make sure we are answering the right questions so you can feel confident making the next right step for your kids. Send us your questions or request guests by emailing us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com, also linked in the show notes.